This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. You'll also find us online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat is with us this afternoon. She joins us once a month to talk about diet and nutrition. So if you have questions about diet, nutrition, give us a call and talk to Susan. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free line. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move. She works with clients of all ages and athletes on enhancing health, fitness, and sports performance. An adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department, she's the consulting sports dietitian for Illini Athletics. She also leads nutrition and cooking classes at the new Division of Campus Recreation ARC building on campus, the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus. A member of the American Dietetic Association and the American College of Sports Medicine, she is the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips, the publisher Coach's Choice. You'll find Susan on the web at www.nutritiononthemove.net. Questions about diet and nutrition are invited this afternoon. Give us a call. Talk to Susan Kundrat. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Yes, good to see you.
We didn't see you last month, so no. It's been a while.
That's right. I was somewhere warm, so that was good.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good. Well, we had a nice talk with Jane Brody last month, so that was interesting. And here you are with us on the second day of American Heart Month.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we start there this
afternoon? I think it is just very exciting, the new research that's come out about diet and heart disease. And I think back, it makes me think back to my first ever job as a dietitian. And I was a cardiac dietitian, would have been 20 years ago or so. And at that time, our recommendations, and I could probably go back and get our diet manual at that time, but you know, at that time, our recommendations really focused on eating less cholesterol. That was really the main thing. Mm-hmm. Less, fewer eggs, for example, which now we know does play a role, but not that, it's not a big problem. Certainly less saturated fat from animal products. We can talk a little bit more about that because that's still very important. But there was very little mention of what to eat back then. In other words, now we have a lot more information on how whole grains really can affect lipids and be helpful. Which foods that have more antioxidants may help decrease inflammation in the body. We've got a lot of new programs and diet plans out, anti-inflammation foods. And now we know so much more about omega-3 fatty acids and how that's helpful. And so I think it gives us a lot more tools that we can work with when planning diets and when looking at what we're really eating on a practical basis to help decrease disease risk for heart disease and really to stay healthy. And I think we know a lot more about exercise now. We always knew it was good for us, but you know, some of the new studies that have come out have really looked at this idea of if you really just try to get those 30 minutes three or four times a week of aerobic exercise, a new study showed that decreased the risk of stroke by 40%. So, you know, there are many things we can do that are feasible for people. And so it's a neat time to be thinking if you're concerned about family history of heart disease or you have high cholesterol or high blood pressure. I think that there are things that can be done that are really not that hard to implement, and we know will hopefully make a difference. So it's great.
Okay. And as the program goes along, when we have a little rest between callers, we'll talk about some of that
Wonderful. Information.
In the meantime, though, we've got someone waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. I have a real basic question. My wife seems to believe that if you get these vacuum-packed packages, specifically smoked fish, that they'll keep forever in a refrigerator. And so we have some hot smoked fish that's been in there for on the order of a year. And I was wondering what you had to say about that.
Well, what I would say first is you know, any food item you get, no matter how they're packaged, I would go by the date.
Well, these have no dates on them. They were packed by an outfit down in Florida.
Okay. Well, I don't know exactly how long that would last, but I wouldn't say a year. if it's a smoked, you know, a smoked product, certainly that has more preservatives in it. And depending upon what's been added, sometimes if they're done naturally, they don't have as many preservatives in them. So it may be dependent on how they're done. But I wouldn't eat it if you've had it for a year. That's for sure.
Is there a botulism hazard?
Well, certainly there could be a wide variety of food poisoning, you know, problems. You know, other things besides botulism, but just to be safe, you know, I would, if you have something that doesn't have a date on it, that's maybe packaged, someone did themselves, or it's not a product that's been purchased, the best bet is always to eat that as soon as possible, because you don't know exactly how it was preserved.
Yep.
So I always say with food, better safe than sorry.
Okay. And if it has nitrites in it, is it?
Well, that does help with the preservatives, certainly. I would maybe contact the person who, or the company that did it, or the person who did it, and find out.
What's,
you know,
the shelf life?
Yeah, what's the shelf life? How they packaged it? Those kinds of things.
Okay, I can do that.
Yeah, that would be smart, because we do know from data on foodborne illness that a lot of times things that are made at home are sort of packaged on their own and not necessarily through a company could be a problem. Of course, we also know with the peanut butter scare that's been out that places that are supposed to be, you know, reviewed can also have a lot of problems. So, but I always say if you're at all concerned or you wonder, it's best not to eat it,
yeah,
just because you don't want to develop a problem like that.
All right, thank you.
Mm. You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. I know occasionally I buy a dry-cured salmon like that in the grocery store, and
yeah,
there's a definite date on it, and it says, it doesn't say best buy, it says not to be consumed after.
Yeah.
So it's not forever.
Right, right. And it always is better to, if you have any questions about food, I would say try to contact the place where it was packaged or find out more about it. But certainly anybody who's been through any foodborne illness or food poisoning would probably agree that it's not worth the risk of having that.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Registered dietitian Susan Kundra is with us this afternoon to take your questions about diet and nutrition. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll take another call now. Another caller in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi, my name's Katie.
Hi, Katie.
I was just wondering what the recommendation for caffeine was, like on a daily basis.
Okay. The recommendation for caffeine, we have sort of a safe limit for caffeine for most people, and that's about 300 milligrams a day. Now, depending upon where you get the caffeine, if you have a strong cup of coffee, a real, let's say a 12 or 16 ounce coffee, you could easily get 150 or 200 milligrams of caffeine in that. So it really does depend. We always say a cup of coffee, but now we usually drink a cup of coffee that's two cups of coffee at least. So you're going to get perhaps quite a bit of caffeine in that. The other thing we know about caffeine is that everybody responds to it differently. So there are many people who are used to three big two-cup servings of coffee, strong coffee a day, and that's what they're used to, and it doesn't seem to bother them, and that's going to be well over the 300 milligrams. But in general, a 300 milligram amount is our recommendation. I will say, too, that now with the popularity of energy drinks, all the different types of energy drinks, there are some on the market that are 500 milligrams per can or more, which is why we've had some concern about people drinking those or drinking two or three of those, or mm-hmm, they could be common to be mixed with alcohol, and that could be a problem, too. And so you really want to know what you're drinking. If you're drinking an energy drink, they don't all list the caffeine amount. So if it doesn't list it, I wouldn't really purchase it, because you really should know what you're getting. And it would be a combination of what you get primarily from drinks, but the amount in chocolate and other things like that is pretty minimal. You're not going to get that much in there unless you'd eat a whole lot of chocolate. So probably wouldn't recommend a whole lot of that anyhow.
Cola drinks?
Cola drinks too, certainly sodas and things, and there are some that
what
have
about
the extra
tea?
Caffeine. Pardon?
What about tea?
Tea depends on the type of tea. Of course, there's decaf tea as well, and depends on how strongly it's brewed. But a cup of pretty strong tea may have 40, 50, 60 milligrams of caffeine per an 8-ounce cup. And so, again, that could add up over time. You could get quite a bit of caffeine if you drank a lot, too. So what I tell people is to go with what you're used to. Just be aware that if you notice any changes in heart rate, if you increase caffeine, be aware of how much you're increasing it so that it may not cause a problem for you. The biggest things we'll see, of course, are jitteriness and headache and changes in blood pressure and things like that. The other thing to be aware of is that high intake of caffeine can also decrease absorption of certain nutrients like iron or calcium. And it's somewhat the caffeine, somewhat other things, perhaps in sodas and coffees and teas that can affect that as well. So just to try to be aware, and a moderate consumption amount, we say, is 300 milligrams or below. I will say, too, that I've had some athletes, some young athletes, middle school and high school athletes, who weren't used to drinking much caffeine, who did try some of these different sports products that are out there that have caffeine and ran into some trouble. One young athlete who was sent to the emergency room because he drank a product that had considerable amounts of caffeine in it. So it is important if you're taking something else or a product that you know what's in there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hi. My question has to deal primarily with cholesterol. About 2 years ago, my doctor said that my cholesterol had gotten too high along with blood pressure and that kind of thing, and so I began, you know, a real kind of strenuous weight loss and exercise and that kind of thing, and lost 70 pounds, and she has since taken me off the blood pressure medication, but the cholesterol hasn't responded anywhere near as well. And her thinking is that it may be, you know, there may be some genetics involved. And I had never heard of that before, and I'm just wondering how common an issue that might be.
Well, first, congratulations for all that you've done to decrease your risk of disease and to get off those blood pressure meds is fantastic. As far as the cholesterol goes, you know, cholesterol is in our system, can get there two ways. One way is your body just makes it yourself. And so that's, you may be genetically, like she says, predisposed because your body, for whatever reason, makes more than it needs. And that's one way we get cholesterol. The other way is within the diet. So if you're eating foods that have a lot of cholesterol or have a lot of saturated fat, then that can certainly increase your blood cholesterol levels too. So it can be you know, a problem with high cholesterol from those two reasons. So it may be nothing to do with what you eat. You may be eating perfectly and certainly it's still lowering your risk, but your body may just overproduce or produce more than it needs. And so you know, along those lines, we know that to decrease risk of disease, you just want to get that cholesterol down as one of the things that you do. And sometimes people respond to different foods. I certainly have had clients who respond well to really increasing soluble fibers, for example. You may already be doing that, but if you're eating oatmeal and you're eating a lot of beans and things like that may bind some of those bile acids and take them out of the system, that's one thing.
I also started taking fish oil because mm-hmm. I'd been told that that could be helpful too.
Yeah, fish oil can be helpful, particularly if your triglycerides are high. That we usually recommend the 2 or 3 grams of fish oil a day with high triglycerides, but just to decrease risk of heart disease, it's helpful as well, just a gram a day. So that's great. You know, and there are other things that may decrease blood cholesterol levels that are not that are not just the medicine. And one thing is stanol or sterol esters. I don't know if you're familiar with those. But
no,
those
I'm not.
Those are in things like Benecol or Take Control, or there's some Promise margarines that have the stanol esters in them. They're compounds that look very similar to cholesterol. So you eat them and your body thinks that they're cholesterol and gets tricked, basically, and then they actually just go through the system without being absorbed. But your body, meanwhile, is trying to absorb these things so it can't absorb actual cholesterol. So in many people, that brings down levels 10 to 15%.
Those are called again?
Those are called stanol or sterol esters. We usually think of them. They're in a lot of different products, but probably the most common ones are Benecol, which is a spread, like a margarine spread. Mm-hmm. Take Control is a margarine spread. It's in some soy milks. It's in some rice milk. It's in some yogurt products, things like that. There are chocolates that have stanol esters in them now. Hmm. So there are a lot of different ways you can get it. And you can also get that in supplemental form. And so beta-sitosterol is the typical supplement that you would take that does the same thing. And so those studies are quite good studies, and they can be helpful for some people. And certainly there's other things that you can do as well. Look at products like red rice yeast, which is another supplement that has actually had some good studies come out recently. If you get a very well-controlled supplement, that quality control is good. Some studies have found that you can decrease lipids in some people 20 or 30% on that. And so some people say, well, I'm going to take a break from the drug and I'm going to try some of these other things. Other people, you know, in working with their physician, of course, they may or may not think that that's a prudent way to go. But sometimes that's an option if people are concerned about being on the meds for a long period of time. So there are some other things diet-wise, you know, that can be done. And, of course, you do want to look at your total diet and make sure, are there other places you might be getting more saturated fat that you're not aware of? Are there other things you might be able to add? Knowing that your, you know, familial cholesterol may be a bit high, there are other things you could try to eat consistently that decrease your risk of disease overall or decrease inflammation. Things like Concord grape juice, some good studies on 8 to 16 ounces a day of Concord grape juice, trying to, you know, in a way, in helping with the inflammation or helping with the blood flow in the arteries. And so there's a whole host of foods that we can hopefully talk more about today that also may be beneficial for you.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have osteoporosis, but occasionally I enjoy a cup of coffee, which I heard leaches calcium from your bones. So how much caffeine is it safe to consume given my condition?
Well, if you had a cup of coffee a day, I wouldn't worry about it. I would say that that's okay. You certainly want to be maximizing your calcium, which you're probably already doing.
Yeah, I am doing that.
All those things are very important, but I don't think that a cup of good coffee a day would be enough of a problem. I don't know that we have an exact amount, but I usually tell people if they're having a cup or two of coffee or soda or caffeinated beverage a day, they're still maximizing calcium, then that's probably okay. That's not an excessive amount, and you're going to want to get the calcium throughout the day. We know to spread that out as much as possible.
Right, I know about that.
Yeah, and those things. And so if you really enjoy a good cup of coffee, I would maybe have one a day, and I don't think that would be a problem. I think that could fit in just fine.
Okay, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
You're very welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Susan Kundrat. She's a licensed registered dietitian, and she joins us once a month to talk about diet and nutrition. So if you've got questions regarding diet and nutrition, give us a call and talk to Susan. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Susan is the president of Nutrition on the Move. She's also a member of the American Dietetic Association and the American College of Sports Medicine. She's an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department, and she's the consulting sports dietitian for Illini Athletics. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now. A listener on line one in Urbana. Hi.
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 Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I have a question about white flour and whole wheat flour.
Mm-hmm.
So if I mix white flour with bran and germ, is it as nutritious as whole wheat flour?
Well, that's a good question. You may have lost a few of the nutrients when flour is processed.
Yes.
You lose, of course, some of the fiber and some of the B vitamins and things like that. But
yeah.
When you do add back in bran and some of the germ, then that's very healthy, too. It's certainly very good for you. So in a lot of recipes, what often works well is we would mix white and wheat flour anyway, because sometimes having full whole wheat flour is just too much, doesn't work that well in a lot of recipes. So if it works for you to have white flour as your base and then add in the bran and add in more of that fiber, I think that is great. It's still going to be very nutritious. You're going to add in some of the other key nutrients. It may not be quite the same, but
okay.
I think you might even actually end up having more fiber depending upon how much bran you put in there.
Yeah, but you know, the white flour increases, shoots up your blood sugar level, right?
Well, white flour itself has a little bit higher glycemic index, which is just a response, a blood sugar response, of course. But it's all what you eat with it. In other words, since we don't typically just eat white flour by itself, once you add fiber, once you add other things or you've got protein that you're eating with it, it doesn't have the same response.
Oh, okay.
Right. And so, you know, it's no problem having some white flour in the diet, but you do want to do exactly like you're doing. Try to add some fiber or mix that in with it so that the overall response is not going to be the same as just having white flour. Can I ask what mix you use or how much do you use of everything when you put that mix together?
Oh, yeah. So for one cup of white flour, I add, say, 2 tablespoons of bran, 2 tablespoons of germ.
Okay.
So that, you know, when I mix it, it looks it almost as a consistency and color of whole wheat flour.
Okay.
But could you please tell me which vitamins and minerals I would be losing on this process of
white flour? When whole wheat flour is processed, you lose some of the B vitamins.
Okay.
But there are B vitamins also, you know, when you add back in, right, particularly in the germ. So that's good. You lose the fiber, but that gets added back in the bran.
Yeah.
I guess what I would encourage you to do is that looks like a pretty good mix. I wonder if you could even bump it up a little more. You know, maybe try a mix of 3 tablespoons of each and see how that works in a recipe for you. Another thing that sometimes works well, you could take what you're already doing and perhaps add a tablespoon or two of ground flax meal.
Sometimes I do that.
Okay, so that's great. That would even enhance it even more in terms of adding more of the fibers and the good fat to that. But this is a great idea because you take a white flour that is very processed, and you add some of those nutrients back in.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Next, we go to a listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Yes, hi. I have a question for Susan about the calcium intake. I'm taking about 1,200 milligrams a day supplement, and I found out that I'm lactose intolerant, so I can't have dairy anymore.
Okay.
But I love spinach, and it's really good for me, and I can't eat cruciferous vegetables and stuff. So in that sense, I've heard that the oxalic acid in spinach decreases the absorption of calcium. I was wondering if you take the part of the calcium in the morning and part of the calcium in the evening and eat the spinach in the middle of the day, would the fact that you've digested, hopefully, the calcium, would that work?
Well, that is a really good thing to do because spreading the larger sources of calcium out that you're taking in your supplement at morning and night is very helpful. So that certainly helps. And when we think about this oxalic acid that's in the spinach, and you're right on there, that there are some things like the oxalic acid that bind the calcium so you don't absorb it as well. Typically when we look at studies, it's actually bound in the spinach. So taking spinach with milk product might decrease the calcium a little bit in the milk product, but mostly what's happening is you're not absorbing the calcium in the spinach, the way I understand
it. Oh, it's the spinach.
Right, decreasing the calcium in the spinach.
Okay, so it's not affecting the supplements.
It certainly could affect the supplements if you have them at the same time because that's such a large amount of calcium.
Right.
But sometimes people will say, oh, should I not have, you know, for example, milk with cereal because cereal is fortified with iron and then you won't absorb the calcium. And it's really not that big of a problem, you know, to that extent. But so what will happen is spinach is a fairly good source of calcium for a vegetable. It's just that it's not very well absorbed calcium.
I understand.
But I would do like you're doing, you know, maybe have your big portions of your supplements not with the spinach since you eat a lot of spinach. It's so good for you.
Yeah.
And then maybe think about another, I don't know if yogurt works for you or.
Well, I can't eat dairy.
No dairy at all. Okay.
So and I know soy is not as good a source of calcium as dairy.
Well, and it does depend on what you have. A soy
soy
yogurt.
Milk, some are fortified, though, right?
Sure. They're fortified, and they're absorbed fairly well.
Okay.
And even the calcium in calcium-fortified juice is fairly well absorbed as well.
Okay.
So that would be another good option. So you could think it wouldn't have to be just the dairy. But even soy yogurt works well, or soy kefir. Many people can tolerate that really well.
Okay. I'll try that.
Okay.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Okay. Good luck with that. And some of the juices now are in some of the soy products are coming fortified with calcium and D.
And D, right. which is great because we know we need more D, so that's good.
Yeah, okay. We had the fellow call about cholesterol, and I thought maybe here we could take a moment to talk about that. One of the things that you and I said maybe we could talk a little bit about today was the DASH diet.
Right.
And that apparently has been proven to be or is believed to be pretty effective in lowering blood pressure. Does it also have an impact on cholesterol?
Well, new studies are finding that it does. And the DASH diet, it's termed DASH because the original studies were called the Dietary Approaches to Stopping or to Stop Hypertension. That's where they get DASH. And it's really a combination. It's just basically healthy eating, but it's a combination of foods looking at getting more fruits, getting more vegetables, getting enough calcium, generally from dairy products. But again, it wouldn't have to be if you couldn't tolerate those. So pretty low-fat diet. It does include nuts and beans or other legumes. But it's pretty low-fat. It's pretty low in sugar. It's very moderate in sodium. And if you're eating enough, the trick is really to eat enough of these fresh foods in particular. That's what, when I work with clients, we start with the DASH plan. It's really now considered when someone has high blood pressure, particularly if they're at a point where they might need to go on meds but might not, we usually try the DASH diet first. For many people, the combination of less sodium, more potassium from fruits and vegetables, the calcium, which plays a role in blood pressure control, for many people it seems to decrease lipids. Or decrease blood pressure, but also decrease lipids. There was a new study that came out recently that I have here. Says this antihypertension DASH diet also in the study cut heart disease risk by 24% and stroke by 18%. And we do know that increasing these phytochemicals from fruits and vegetables has been also affiliated with a decrease in stroke incidence. And so overall decrease in heart disease risk by eating this way seems to be, you know, something that we're finding. So it also emphasizes these whole grains, more fiber, more whole grains, less processed food. And often people hear this say, gosh, you know, I'm going to have to cook a lot more. And it's two things. It's getting to the store more frequently because you really do need to eat more fresh produce. Mm-hmm. That's a big thing. And it's also, yeah, maybe once or twice a week making something or making a big pot of soup. We were talking about your black bean soup that you made. You know, making a big pot of soup where you might not have, that may not be the only thing you eat. You might also get a lean hamburger or something. You grab that, but you have a big bowl of soup too. There are ways you can certainly use the DASH diet, but not have to cook every night. And so, it's also a simple thing of thinking, gosh, I'm going to have more bananas and apples and get some frozen strawberries and maybe make a smoothie and some things that don't take a lot of time. But it's a very beneficial diet. I think the early studies, showed benefit. Some people also lost weight eating like this. Of course, most people bump their fiber up in fruits and vegetables. Gosh, they feel more satisfied and they tend to lose weight as well.
Yeah, and in the DASH diet, the emphasis, one of the things that is emphasized is fresh fruit and vegetables, and fresh fruit and vegetables that are rich in magnesium, potassium, and calcium. So
yes.
Can you give us some examples of fruits and vegetables that it would be fairly easy to add in and that would bump up these nutrients?
Sure. Well, one of the things would be the greens, for example, like we talked about spinach, but maybe utilizing kale, for example. You know, a quick thing to do is buy these dark greens like kale at the store, just chop them up, rinse them, chop them up, throw them in your freezer, add those to more things like soups or if you're going to stir fry or something. So these dark greens are very beneficial. Usually they're very high in potassium and they also are high in calcium as well and have some magnesium. Things like papayas that you might not think about that we don't have around that much, but peaches that also are very high in potassium, even canned peaches are extremely good sources of potassium. We think about bananas. We think about foods like oranges or orange juice or other citrus fruit, that the things like the tangerines that are available now are really good sources. Many berries have some potassium in them and also have some little bit of calcium. And so if people just try to think about eating a wide variety of fruits and vegetables, then they're automatically going to increase their potassium significantly. And many of those have small amounts of calcium as well. One of the things with this plan is it wasn't just necessarily a low-fat plan and increasing more produce, but having dairy and nuts and seeds that are good sources of magnesium, for example, and the calcium did seem to make a difference too. So What I encourage people to do is think about, can I just branch out when I'm eating as far as my produce? And don't forget about frozen and canned, especially this time of year. Another good, very good source of potassium is dried apricots and dried fruit in general. They're very high in potassium. They're also pretty high in calories, but
so just bump down the size of mm-hmm. what you're eating.
Right. If you have a quarter cup or so, or 3 or 4 tablespoons of dried fruit, that's a serving. So that's not very much, but that certainly is a good source of a lot of these nutrients as well. And we mentioned yogurt before. You know, a lot of people, some people say, oh, I tried yogurt several years ago and I didn't like it. But, you know, really think about, there are so many brands and so many types now that usually people find something that they do like. And then you've got great protein, you have magnesium, you have calcium, you have potassium, you have a lot of these things in a food, even if you don't like to drink milk, or maybe the soy yogurt brands or the vegan yeah. brands.
Or buy vanilla yogurt and add your own fruit or
exactly.
your own granola to it or whatever
exactly.
you'd like.
It's a great option. So, you know, taking a look and trying to make sure that when we cut down fats and sugars in the diet, we drop a lot of calories. And so just a real simple way to think about, gosh, if I'm just going to cut one sweet out a day or one dessert out a day that I would normally have 2 or 3 a day, then that makes a big difference right there. And, you know, a candy bar is about the same as about 7 or 8 oranges when you think of the calories. So you can eat a lot of fruit to make up for one little
and you can
candy
eat a
bar.
Lot of vegetables.
And even more vegetables.
And, you know, cups and cups.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Not breaking the bank at all.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there was an interesting article recently in the newspaper. We got a couple of calls here on that. We'll get to them immediately. Not quite immediately, but I did want to talk a little bit about sodium because mm-hmm. the DASH diet also takes a hack at that.
Right.
And I read here in this article, let me just share this with you. Dietary guidelines going back to the 1980s, they really wanted to hit on this message to cut down on sodium,
mm-hmm.
on salt.
Mm-hmm.
But by the year 2000, men were consuming 48% more salt than they did in the early 70s, and women 69% more.
Wow, yeah.
And this is in part because food got saltier, but also portion sizes got bigger.
Sure, I can see both ways, and people eating out more.
Yeah.
Because so much that, you know, eating out really increases the sodium intake as well. And we know that not everybody, we think about 50% of people are salt sensitive, meaning that if you have high blood pressure, the eating more salt's really going to make it worse. Or if you're at risk for high blood pressure, eating more salt is going to put you up there a lot faster. And we know the body as we get older just can't manage that as well. It's just such a higher incidence of high blood pressure as we get older too. So that's where looking at what you're eating that's processed or eating out and those kinds of things, really that makes a big difference with the sodium intake. And now we do know, like with the DASH diet, that a lot of focus has been on getting people to eat more potassium-rich foods because there is a balance there that if you get more potassium and less sodium in the diet, that really for many people modulates blood pressure. And that helps a lot as well as getting enough calcium.
Okay, let's take another call now. Listener on a cell phone, line one, hi.
Hi, I have a question. I just heard a moment ago, I'm on paying attention to traffic, so please forgive me, but eat a lot more fruit. And I just want to say, what happens if, unfortunately, you're a diabetic and you throw that into the mix of arthritis, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and so on, and fruit becomes a restricted item? What do you do then?
Well, it's
good
a good
question.
Yeah, very good question. Well, let me back up a second. And when we think about, when we talk about diabetes, it's not that fruit needs to necessarily be limited way down. Everybody's plan is different, of course, and different people respond differently to different fruits, and that's there's no question about that. But what we know now about diabetes is the body mostly responds to the amount of carbohydrate. And so there are a lot of fruits that are very low carbohydrate fruits. Some examples are oranges, for example, and tangerines and melon and strawberries. And those fruits are actually not that high in sugar. They're not that high in carbohydrate. So it may be that you eat fewer bananas and apples and some of these more concentrated sources of carbohydrate and go more for the berries, because that would be an easy way to still get your fruit in, get all these antioxidants, get all the benefits, but not have the calories or not have the carbohydrate. So that's one option, is to think of some of these low-carbohydrate fruits. Another thing to think about is what you're pairing that fruit with. In other words, many people with diabetes do pretty well. They manage blood sugars pretty well if they mix a fruit with something with protein and fat. So a good example there might be 3 or 4 tablespoons of almonds, which we know are very good for us, have that with a tangerine. So here's your fruit, which is great. You're getting also some protein and fat. So when you eat that together, it's not just straight sugar. So the body generally can manage that better, of course, and keep your blood sugars down. So it might be that you or someone with diabetes would really have to say, gosh, what am I eating that fruit with? And which type of fruit am I eating? So that I'm not necessarily just getting a whole lot of carbohydrate at one time and keeping my servings down.
Given, again, with the amounts, like 3 or 4 servings of fruit a day, mm-hmm. I mean, you could eat that in one meal. At least I could.
Oh, sure.
And yet, instead I'm told something in the 2 or 3 servings of fruit a day is the best you can hope for. I might be able to increase that, I believe, if I understood you right, by the selection of fruit and a particular, and then adding a mix of protein and fat with it. Is
right.
that basically
right.
it?
Right, exactly.
Right.
Even
Thank
something.
Thanks
yes.
for the call. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, some other examples might be a grapefruit, for example. Grapefruit is not very high in sugar. It's really high in nutrients, particularly red grapefruit or the dark grapefruits. And it's also very filling. So if you peel a whole grapefruit and have a whole grapefruit, maybe you have that and you have a cheese stick, mozzarella cheese stick, which has some sodium, but certainly has a little protein and a little bit of fat. Or again, you think about nuts, or nuts always come in easily because they're so portable and they're so good for you. You know, you could do something like that 3 or 4 times a day as a snack or added to the meal. One thing we know about carbohydrate is that we really don't want to eat too much at any one time. So for a lot of my clients, we take fruit out of the meals and we put fruits in the snack. So, for example, a meal might look like you've got some grilled salmon, you've got a salad, you've got steamed green beans, and maybe, you know, a slice of bread. And so that meal as a whole is really not that high in carbohydrate. But then between, you might have your carbs come from fruits. And so between, you might have an apple and peanut butter. Or you might have, again, a smoothie before you go to bed that's got a cup of fresh strawberries, which are not high in sugar. They're not high in carbohydrate. And you mix that with a sugar-free yogurt, and there's your smoothie. And so you get some protein with that yogurt. And so there are ways that you can mix in those fruits between meals and then keep your meals for veggies and your protein and a few grains. And that way, you never get too much carbohydrate at one time. And that's something we're really looking for with people with diabetes or managing blood sugars, is the amount of food and the amount of carbohydrate at one time probably needs to come down.
How often is it recommended that diabetics look at their diet and, you know, kind of review it with a dietitian?
Well, the more the better. I mean, sometimes people will go to a dietitian once and they may not see him again for 10 years, but boy, their whole body's changed and their needs may have changed and everything too. So a couple things people can think about. If they've had a real change in their medications or had a change in medical concerns, you know, maybe someone might have started with high blood sugars, but now they also have high cholesterol. That's a time you should revisit your nutrition plan with a dietitian. Or if you've gained or lost a significant amount of weight, if someone's changed their weight by 15 or 20 pounds or more, probably a good time to relook at your diet, because your diet needs may have changed as well during that time. And so, or if you're having more trouble managing blood sugars for one reason or another, obviously that's a good time to take a look. And I would tell people too, if they've been to a dietitian 5 years ago or 10 years ago or even longer, a lot has changed since that time with diabetes too. We talked about that at the beginning with cardiovascular disease. We just know so much more. We can do so much more diet therapy now than we could do 10 or 20 years ago. And the same is true for diabetes. Sometimes people will come to me and they haven't been to a dietitian for so long and they say, I've cut this out and I don't eat this and I feel so deprived. And now we say, well, you can incorporate those things in. Let's figure out how so that you know you can eat everything. And it's really not as restrictive as it used to be.
Yeah, I think I would like to do that just to say I'm kind of in a rut,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's some new things I'd like to eat. Is it okay?
Right.
So, all right.
Exactly.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign County, line 2. Hi.
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 I'm currently on warfarin and a statin, warfarin to thin the blood, and it's terrible as far as diet is concerned. All the green stuff and the cruciferous vegetables are counteract the warfarin. Do you have any help on that?
Yeah, the warfarin, or the Coumadin, as you say, which is a pretty common medication people are on, does...
It's rat poison. And
yeah, but and it does what it's supposed to do. It thins, keeps the blood at the, you know, thin enough, which is important. And again, we've kind of had a change in heart, you know, in terms of how we view Coumadin now, and really from a diet therapy standpoint. It used to be we would say, yes, if you're on Coumadin, don't eat any of these foods that might clot the blood, that might have vitamin K, basically high vitamin K levels and clot the blood. But now we don't say not to eat those. We say the most important thing is you keep your diet consistent, because we know that the Coumadin levels, they can be adapted. They can be, or the amount of Coumadin can change when you're getting your blood tested. They can change that. They can add a little bit or take a little bit away. But if your diet is consistent, that tends to be the most important thing. So in other words, if you eat 3 servings of vegetables a day, you just want to keep eating 3 servings of vegetables a day. You don't want to make a big change in your diet. But if you maybe talk to your doc and say, I really want to incorporate more of these foods, can we go for a trial period and monitor my blood a little bit more till I get to, you know, we get to maybe where the medicine's working with the diet? And so we really don't say don't eat those foods anymore, but it is important that if you try to incorporate those, we kind of, you're monitoring with your doc to make sure that you might need a little change in the medication. But I always feel like it's better to make sure you're getting your fruits and vegetables and then you're just consistent with those. And then the med can be changed a little bit if it needs to be. Now, that may not be what your doctor wants to do, but that's an option that some physicians are fine with. That way we can maximize the diet at the same time, keeping the blood where it needs to be.
Well, unfortunately, the consistency of diet is going to vary, because I have garden vegetables that arrive suddenly, and leafy greens in the garden that invite great salads and things of that sort. Just means I have to get checked more often then.
Yeah, and the other thing to think about is if you do have foods like that from the garden, and there are some things that you can freeze. You can't freeze all the leafy greens, of course, but if you have some kale, like we mentioned, or things like that that you can freeze and know that you're just going to have a serving of that a day, even later on when you can pull them out of the freezer, then that helps. You can still enjoy them, but maybe you're not having too much at one time.
Well, in a cold frame, kale will survive until January anyway.
You're in good shape there.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call.
Good luck.
And one last call this afternoon, and we'll have to be quick, though. Chicago, line 4. Hi.
Anne-Louise Yerderman wrote a book some time ago, Why Am I Always So Tired? And she points out a particular significant correlation between copper overload and zinc deficiency as a contributing factor to a whole host of particular problems. I don't know if you ever explored it or heard of their book, and I just recently got it, and it really is a wonderful contribution to our insight on health and nutrition. So I was wondering, in some future time, you might want to explore the balance between copper and zinc, a certain ratio, and certain foods that are high in copper that might be contributing to a whole host of problems. I thank you for your program very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
that's a good idea. There's a lot of interest in that right now, and kind of the ratio, particularly with people supplementing with zinc and making sure you have enough copper if you're doing that. So I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, maybe next time.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have you on the show next month.
See you next month.
All
Nutrition
right.
Month is March.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
First Monday in March, Susan Kundrat will be back with us. Susan is a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move. She's an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. She's the consulting sports dietitian for Illini Athletics, and she joins us usually once a month on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet and nutrition.